I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
On this podcast edition of Tell Somebody, a quick interview with a fast food worker from the December 4, 2014 strike, and a trip to the archives for a 2008 interview with Phil Donahue and Ellen Spiro, and a 2002 commentary called The Good Germans. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello, and welcome to the Tell Somebody podcast for December 11, 2014. www.tellsomebody.us. Follow me on Twitter, at TellSomebodyNow, and look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook and like it. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clammer. On Thursday, December 4, 2014, fast food workers rallied in over 190 cities across the United States for $15 and a union. Locally, after an early morning action in Kansas City, Kansas, workers rallied on the Missouri side at 84th and Warnell Road. After gathering and speaking, they marched down 85th Street and then through Sunnyside Park, where many of them had parked, and dispersed. I caught up with a Wendy's worker there and recorded this short interview. Give a listen.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Ravon Herbert, a.k.a. Debo the Great.
All right. What brings you out here today?
Man, I'm fighting for 15 with all my brothers and sisters. Stand up, KC. We out here, man.
Do you work in fast food yourself?
Yes, sir. I've been working at this Wendy's on Truman Road in Missouri off of Cleveland next to the Millennium for about a year. I've been doing fast food work forever, you know, as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of people say that these fast food jobs are just for high school kids getting a little extra spending money. They don't need to be a living wage. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that you got to understand that this is all the jobs they putting out there. Our economy is so messed up. So you got people with high school diplomas and degrees that the only place that they can get right in is fast food, you know. So, I mean, it's not just for kids, but why would America want to pay their kids such a low rate? You know, so that's what I would say to them, you know.
I've heard that in the several years this has been going on every year or so, nobody's been fired because of it. Do you ever worry about recriminations from your boss for participating in this?
No, sir. Like I said, my name is Von Herbert. I work on Wendy's on Truman Road. I've been on strike 4 times, and I never got fired. I mean, my boss actually started to respect me more after the fact that, you know, I went on strike and I showed them I will fight for something, you know, and they respect that. I mean, a lot of GMs don't take it personal, but, you know, if anybody is worried about fighting, you know, you can take it from me 4 times, and I haven't been fired. I mess up like every other human on the job. So, you know, I would say it's a pretty fair ordeal. They tell you can fight and you got the right, and when they say that, they mean that.
How do you feel like it went today compared to other times you participated in the past, you said?
Yes. Well, I mean, every strike we do stand up for KC, it's always bigger than the other one. I mean, with this one, I feel the energy, and we really out here for a lot of causes. We out here not just for us, because when they give us 15 in the union, it's going to be like a whirlwind or, you know, a chain reaction like dominoes or something. They're going to have to do the rest of the U.S., so, yeah, that's how I feel on that.
I've heard 190 cities across the country today.
Yeah, it's 190 today, so, I mean, we deep as ever could be. And we got all types of supporters that already got unions, and they out here in the cold with us. So, I mean, it's a beautiful day for us, for real.
What kind of results have you seen from what you've done in past years? Anything real substantial?
I mean, as far as, like, the money change go, nah, but, I mean, you got to understand, these people talk to you like dogs, grown people. So I seen just the respect go to it. You know, they try to treat us with respect now. You know, they worried about offending our rights, so we got them on their toes because they know we're not doing nothing wrong. We protesting and we striking because it's the right we get.
A lot of police blocking some streets and stuff here. Any police problems at all?
I mean, the police, they not like real aggressive. I mean, they saying a little stuff, but they got to understand we not out here for violence. We out here for to make our lives better. You know, we out here doing nonviolent protesting and striking. So, I mean, They're not bad, but they're in our way. You know, we could get a lot more done if they wasn't following us around town.
Any final words you want to leave with our listeners before I let you go?
I just want to say, man, supporters, Stand Up KC. We got a page on Facebook and I guess the other social media sites. And if you want to, you know, just contact us and maybe you could be a supporter, because it's not just for us. It's for everybody. Make America better.
StandUpKC.org and StandUpKC on Facebook.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, sir. Have a good day.
I wasn't sure at first what I was going to do on the show this week, but on Sunday night, I decided to re-air a couple of old audio files. Thomas Young has been on my mind, well, ever since I met him, but especially since his untimely death on the eve of Veterans Day and just a couple of weeks before his 35th birthday. I tried to gather up all my Thomas Young-related audio and became very frustrated that I couldn't find an interview with Phil Donahue and Ellen Spiro for the Kansas City premiere of their Thomas Young film, Body of War. The audio files on my computer were lost in a hard drive crash a couple of years ago, and I spent a lot of time going through stacks and stacks of CDs in the basement and not finding a copy. I had just about given up, but then on Sunday night, I found a CD on a shelf in my home office. After listening to the interview for the first time in years, I decided that what Donahue and Spiro had to say is worth hearing again now. And by the way, the film is still very much worth a second or a first look. www.bodyofwar.com. Give a listen now to Body of War filmmakers Ellen Spiro and Phil Donahue, recorded in February of 2008. Most Americans above a certain age remember an iconic photograph of the Vietnam War. In the photograph, a little girl, completely naked, arms outstretched, her clothes burned off by napalm, is running down a road screaming in pain and fear, along with four other children and some Vietnamese soldiers. This picture shaped the image of the war for many Americans. Phil Donahue told me that that photograph was his inspiration for the effect he hoped to achieve with Body of War, the film he co-produced and co-directed with Ellen Spiro. Ellen Spiro is a documentary filmmaker. Among many other awards, she has received the Foundation of American Women in Radio and Television's Gracie Award for Outstanding Director and Outstanding Documentary, and is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and is a two-time Rockefeller Fellowship recipient. In 2000, Spiro joined producer Karen Bernstein to start Mobilis Media, a nonprofit production company to make social issue documentaries. She is currently an associate professor at the University of Texas in Austin. John Philip Donahue is best known as the creator and star of The Phil Donahue Show, the first tabloid talk show. The show had a 26-year run on television, preceded by 3 years of local broadcast in Dayton, Ohio, before ending in 1996. His shows have generally focused on issues that often divide liberals and conservatives in the U.S., such as abortion, consumer issues, and war protests. Donahue also hosted a talk show on MSNBC from 2002 to 2003, and perhaps not least, he is married to that girl, Marlo Thomas. I had the pleasure of sitting down to speak
with Ellen Spiro and Phil Donahue last Tuesday. Ellen Spiro and Phil Donahue, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom.
How did you first hear about and meet Thomas Young? Was it something to do with Ralph Nader, did I hear?
Well, it did. I was visiting Ralph Nader after the 2004 election, and I thought, you know, he and I go way back. Ralph Nader appeared on the Donahue Show more than any other single person in the 29 years we were on the air. So in over 6,000 programs, he was the most often featured guest. And if it sounds like I'm bragging, I am. He did wonderful, wonderful shows for us. He drew a crowd. People responded to Ralph. And so we're attached at the hips, as you might say. And I went to see him. I thought if anybody deserved a hug after the 2004, I went to see him, and in the middle of the conversation, he said, a mother at Walter Reed wants to see me. Do you want to go? So off we go. A week later, I fly back, and we go. And I met this young man. It's hard to say I met him because he was wall-to-wall morphine at that time.
When was that?
This would have been January or February of 05. So we're talking over 3 years ago.
And he was injured, was it March or April?
March
of
04.
April 4th, 2004.
April of 04. And you may know Thomas is a T4, which anatomists will tell you is a position on the spine, which has been severed by a bullet. And Thomas is paralyzed from the nipples down. And it was during my visit to that room with Ralph that I met Thomas's mother. And I began to process the gravity of this injury. At the time, he was 25, 24 or 20. And, I mean, just it's hard to explain. As you stand there with this perfectly functioning body, looking at this prime of life kid. And so I thought, well, people should see this. You know, America should see this. Don't sanitize the war. Show the truth. Show the pain. That's what I think we're obliged to do as journalists. And from then, through a series of meetings, I was very fortunate to have called to my attention a company in Austin, Texas, Mobilis Media. And I call Mobilis Media. And a female voice answers, and I say, I'm Phil Donahue. And I waited, and I prayed, and thank God she recognized me. So, all right, now that's step one.
What does Mobilis Media do?
Mobilis Media is a film company. They do independent documentaries. And the filmmaker in that very small company is Ellen Spiro, with whom I was speaking on the telephone after having been recommended by a person that I trust. Now remember, I don't know, I really don't have any idea about her body of work. She has seen me on television, but we had a blind date. I met her in the Kansas City airport, and off we go to meet Thomas Young, two of us. We have just met, things started happening fast. First of all, Ellen grabbed the story with both hands, immediately wanted to do this. So I'm making this one inch at a time, you know. Is this family going to accept us, you know? Stranger from New York parachutes into their living room. And it all worked out because Ellen was not only a brilliant cinematographer and co-director. I mean, I got lots of help on this film. She was also received by the family. And this is hugely important. You know, if the family doesn't like the cinematographer, you're nowhere. Well, they not only liked Ellen, they really, you know, they all but made her a member of the family. And the trust that she was able to develop with Thomas and his family, it just made an enormous contribution to this film. So what you see in this film is the drama of Thomas trying to rise from the ashes. Thomas has bowel and bladder problems. Thomas has erectile dysfunction, 26-year-old male, primal life. You know, the closer you get to this, the more it just blows you back. I just You can't explain. Thomas can't cough because he has no stomach muscle. Our movie features a wedding. You know, we're not saying we're better. We do believe that we are different. And we also believe that our movie can draw a crowd. That's our challenge. And we have been so well received. I mean, I wouldn't tell you this if it weren't true. It's really been stunning.
I'm hearing Oscar buzz for next year.
Actually, we were nominated. We came very close to be nominated this year. I think that's what we're allowed to say. We survived the final 15. We made it to the short list. We were not, however, named in the final 5.
But you're still eligible for next year?
No,
I doubt it. You had to have been this year.
You had to be this year.
Okay.
So that would have helped us. And we really, our hearts were broken, to be honest with you. Because it would have helped us so much, you know. The buzz from the Oscars is just unequaled. But, you know, we go to shoot a movie with the promotion that we have. And we've had a lot of nice notices. We've been very well reviewed. I tell you this because we realize that we have, you know, Little Miss Sunshine, we ain't. And so we're about the business of letting people know that this is a movie I think they will be glad they saw.
And you're opening in Kansas City, I believe, March 7th. I saw something about a premiere at a festival in Toronto. Where else has it played, and what kind of reactions?
Let's get Ellen in. The talk show guy, you know, you can't control.
We premiered the film in Toronto, which was an amazing experience, and Eddie Vedder was there performing the song that he wrote for our film. Actually, he wrote a few songs for our film. We went to Los Angeles to the AFI Festival. We went to the Hamptons. We won awards in most of these festivals. And we're on our way to Austin, Texas, to South by Southwest Film Festival. After that, we opened theatrically. Kansas City actually is the first city that we are opening theatrically in, and then Austin. And then it's going to be a rollout across the country in various landmark theaters.
Body of War opens March 7th, a Friday, at the Tivoli Theater in Kansas City. March 7th, Friday. And Ellen and I will be parking cars for those who come. And
there will be free popcorn. And this film is about Kansas City people. We shot most of this film here in Kansas City. There's a wonderful cinematographer here named Kevin McKinney, who shot a good part of the film as well. We worked with sound people here. And this is a Midwestern Kansas City family, so we thought it would be really special to open the film here. And a good opportunity for people here to meet this family, both through the film and then perhaps in person. The film really brings the war home, not in a depressing way, but in a very hopeful way. You'll have to watch the film to see the ending, but it ends on a very positive note. It ends on a note that maybe there is hope, not just for Thomas Young and his family, but for our country and for the democratic process that has been compromised over the last several years.
Well, I think a lot of us are much in need of a hopeful message these days. What did you think when Phil Donahue got on the phone? Tell me about your beginnings with this film.
Well, Phil, you know, once I got over that, you know, he was real and that really was him, we just started working on the film. And the first question I always ask myself about a documentary story has to do with the characters. And can this person hold a film? And my immediate intuition about Thomas was that he was an amazing individual. And then when I met his mother, I felt the same way. But Phil Donahue is someone I grew up with. You know, I guess one of the four major role models in my life, or people that had an influence on me. You know, there's various stages of your life. There's my father, there's Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Rogers, and then in the teenage years, it was Phil Donahue. And really, I grew up in the boonies, you know, and so he brought new ideas into my consciousness And it wasn't the male strippers, mind you, but it was other shows. You know, he had gay people on his shows that he presented as normal people, and all kinds of interesting alternative ideas that I was exposed to through television. And I think, you know, that's one of a few of my experiences with television that was good and made me want to reach people through the medium, because, you know, you really can affect change that way. So he was a big influence in my life, but I almost hung up the phone on him because I didn't think it was really him. And then, you know, then he convinced me that it was, and we went from there.
But you must have had some sort of track record that led somebody to recommend you.
Yes, you did.
I love stories about real people, and I love making documentaries, and I've been doing it since I was young, almost 20 years. And I've never had that desire that I've been asked so many times, do you want to make a fiction, you know, a real, quote, real movie? And the answer is no, because real people are constantly surprising me and interesting me. And one of the things that keeps us going in documentaries is not knowing what's around the corner. And with this film, it was more like that than any other I've worked on. It was just so full of surprises. The story takes a lot of interesting twists and turns, and it keeps the viewer riveted. And that word actually didn't come from me. It came from a reviewer. But you're with the story the whole way through, and it's very compelling because of all these changes that are happening with Thomas and his life, and the revelations of how we got into the war that will surprise the viewer.
And this is not just a story about Thomas Young. It's also about, as you said, how we got into the war. I sort of get that from the trailer, but
yes. Thomas, first of all, Ellen brought back material that was just, I mean, some of it made you wince. Some of it made you cry. I ought to know. And all of it was usable. I mean, this is how lucky I got. I mean, I picked up the phone, called a great dark space, and heard a female voice on the phone. And when I realized, you know, this could have been, you know, maybe just a ham-handed person, or a show-off person, or a person who, you know, thinks they know everything. And she wasn't. And by the way, I'm an A personality myself, and here we were. You know, nobody helped me do my show for 29 years. I was out there all by myself. Now I have a partner. She's a co-director. Well, you can imagine. And somehow we have survived.
It worked, huh?
Well, it did. It, you know, it's an emotional experience anyway. But when you put in a paralyzed 20-something person as your protagonist, you know, it becomes not only a matter of the heart, but it just involves you in every way. You know, if he's depressed, you're depressed. You know, and then we had to resolve our own creative differences. So a lot of things were in the air, in midair, that we were trying to juggle. And we also knew that Thomas didn't want a movie that showed exclusively his dealing with his paralysis, although it surely does that because of Ellen. If we just show that, then it's a movie. The movie becomes, oh lad, poor lad, how sad. And Thomas did not want that film. Thomas is a political animal. Thomas is a bright light, and we ought to know. Thomas has insight, humor. He's well educated, and he can talk to anybody. And when Thomas speaks, people can't take their eyes off him. He has become, for the wrong reason, to be sure, but he's become a very powerful voice. He is a powerful anti-war voice. And we are hopeful. We believe that our film enhances his megaphone. I showed the film to Bob Graham, the former governor of Florida, and a three-term senator who has recently retired. And when he finished watching the film, he turned around to me. And he said, this film should be shown in every college and university in this country. Well, the air went out of my body, grateful that somebody on the inside saw the value of our film. Remember, we're hardly your most objective people here, about, you know, it's like saying, do you think I have a beautiful baby? You know, who's going to say no? I don't trust any of my friends. I showed them all the film, and they all said how wonderful it was, and I didn't believe them. So you go out there, you know, very, very wondering if you have a beautiful baby. And the response has been huge, really great for us. Now, here I am with Ellen, lucky, boom, just pulled out of a hat. And then, by accident, I run into Eddie Vedder, whom I
was going to ask, how did he get into this?
I mean, he was on the Nader bus with me in 2000.
Oh.
2000, I was on the Nader campaign. We did all the super rallies, Michael Moore. And Eddie would play the guitar and sing at the end of the rally. Madison Square Garden, Target in Minneapolis, Fleet, Boston, we were everywhere. I have to say, you know, I didn't know who Eddie Vedder was. I'm 72 years old. A one and a two and the champagne music lady. And I realized very quickly how powerful he was. I mean, this guy sells out around the world. And I met him, in 2000 on the Nader bus. And then I ran into him accidentally several years later in Phoenix. And I said, Eddie, Phil. I said, Eddie, I'm doing an anti-Iraq war documentary. And he says, you want a song? I grabbed him. This is exactly how it happened. 3 days later, he's in my apartment watching the film in New York. He flies home to Seattle, calls Thomas on the phone. Thomas was over the moon. Eddie Vedder's calling him. Talked to Thomas for more than an hour. And in 4 days, in an MP3 file, in my email, I get a song, which is the signature song of our movie. Now, how's that for good luck? I mean, I get Eddie Vedder, we get Eddie Vedder on our poster. That's a demo that you don't normally, you know, that I don't know how we would attract these people without Eddie. And I think Eddie's going to be the difference for us in getting young people in to see this film. Because as Bob Graham of Florida said, everybody in college in America should see this film. And by the way, we agree with him.
And Ellen, you were talking about the, I started to say soundtrack. You say it's not actually a soundtrack, but the CD that's coming out in March. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Thomas, you know, the main character in Body of War, is a big music fan. And music was his therapy during much of his injury and even before his injury when he got over to Iraq. He has more CDs than anybody I know, and he's constantly listening to music. It was his idea to put together an album of anti-war songs, and he selected the songs, and he and Eddie Vedder wrote letters to all the artists, and miraculously, one after another, agreed for free to include their music on this album, which is the same name as our film, Body of War. And it's released in conjunction with the film. It's got Bruce Springsteen, Neil Young, Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, Bright Eyes, Michael Franti and Spearhead, System of a Down, Brandon James. It goes on. Tori Amos, Laura Cantrell,
Yoko Ono.
John Lennon. And what's really neat about the album is that it's cross-generational. So you have songs that represent all of us as sort of anti-war anthems, some new, some old, and some in between.
And the album is titled Body of War. Thank you very much for that help, Eddie Vedder.
Where did we get that title?
I wonder.
Phil thought of that title. It's great because I don't know if people immediately pick up on the nuances there, but the body of war is not just the body of Thomas Young, but it's also the body of government that got him to the war. So it's a nice title, plus it starts with a B.
And it puts us early on the alphabetical list. The other body happens to be the United States Congress. And what you see in our film, woven throughout Thomas's story, which, by the way, is told without any kind of coloring or sanitizing what he's going through. I mean, you see the pain, which was our intention to begin with. My own inspiration for the film was that shot of the naked girl running from the napalm in Vietnam. Oh, do you remember that? Nixon mentioned her once in a speech. That photograph won a Pulitzer Prize. You know, I see that as journalism as it should be. See the pain, don't sanitize the war, tell people the truth, don't let them make this out to be some kind of merry little exercise. This is serious, it takes people's lives. The troops are not fallen, they are dead. Let's start using language that speaks the truth. Stop all this buffering that we're doing to protect ourselves from the horror of this kind of exercise. So that was our grand mission as we entered this project. And I've already talked about how lucky I was to find Ellen and that I accidentally bumped into Eddie Vedder. We're also very, very fortunate to have found a very unusual and receptive family in Kansas City. We are nowhere if they don't like us or want us. And somehow, they do. And I shouldn't be surprised because it's really the work, Ellen. This is Ellen's work.
No, well, Phil definitely paved the way and has been to Kansas City probably more times than he can count. Phil was involved in every part of the process and spent a lot more time in the editing room than I did. He watched every second of footage, which at first I couldn't believe he wanted to, but he watched every second of footage, and he went through all of the hours of C-SPAN footage of the debate that led us into the war, and he culled the most precious little gems from this material to create something incredibly dynamic that moves the story along with something revealing. Even though C-SPAN is something anybody can watch, the way that it was edited is an expose of sorts of how we got into this mess that we're still in.
You know, all the current controversy about why doesn't Hillary apologize? She voted for the war. How long is she going to hang on to who voted for the war, who didn't? Did Obama, who, by the way, was not in the Congress at the time. This was the October 2002 Iraq War Resolution. The President of the United States says to Congress, I need your permission to go to war if I have to. First of all, that's unconstitutional. Only Congress can declare war. But since the early 40s, Congresses have refused to do that. It's much too dangerous. It's a third rail. If you're wrong, you can lose your job, and nobody wants it. So they close their eyes, turn their back, and then hand off a letter which essentially says, here, Mr. President, if you have to. And then they're absolved. They CYA. They're cover your... And that's what they've done. And you see it in this film. And you see the bumper sticker, superficial, unbelievably shallow debate that took place in both houses of Congress in October 2002 that has led to more than a million deaths, 4,000 American soldiers, men and women coming home in the coffins that mainstream media is not allowed to take a picture of. People come out of our movie, I have to say, and they're wobbly. And many of them sit there and watch those credits, and they say, oh my God, after watching this thing, I have to do something. We are very proud of the fact that this film really motivates people. No longer are they say to themselves, I am no longer going to stand mute while this continues.
We know a little bit from the history of your show being canceled, other indications that you knew certain things, and I get a little tired of hearing people say, well, if we knew then what we knew now, because I've talked to Ray McGovern, I've talked to Scott Ritter on the air, other people, they knew, or at least should have had the questions in mind much, much more seriously than they did. But going through all of this, and you're
more tuned into this than typical John Q. public, but have you learned a lot in going through all this C-SPAN and going through this process of making the movie?
I learned how if you frighten the people, you can do just about anything. No less a historic figure than Hermann Göring told us this. And this president, Saddam is coming. He's got this. He's got that. He's outside your bedroom window. He's under your bed. You can't believe that. I mean, it's almost that bad. We have a senator stands up. The person, the country that stops Saddam will save the world. He says that on the floor of the Senate. This is unbelievable. This president took this entire nation and the Congress by the ear and led it right into the sword and has chipped away at the Bill of Rights, listening in on telephone calls, opening email, people in cages, no Red Cross, no lawyers, no phone calls, no nothing. This is chipping away the bedrock of this nation. And while this was happening, the American people largely stood mute. We're arguing in public about whether waterboarding is torture. We name our invasions shock and awe. You know, this is silliness. We look like we're not a serious nation. And the mainstream media, I mean, every major metropolitan newspaper in this country supported this war. Imagine. Everybody in October 2002 and in March of 2003, the month of the invasion, everybody, it seemed to me, everybody in America wanted to bomb somebody. And that's the exact kind of heavy breathing, impulsive, impatient decision making that the framers sought to prevent by placing exclusively the power to declare war within the Congress and not at the White House.
You talked about, or one of you talked about, optimism. Tell me again where that comes from, because we still got that media. I've met you at the last two Free Press Media Reform conferences. I hope to see you at the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always wondering how much to blame the politicians who voted for this, how much to blame the awful media, and in spite of all that, how much to blame all of us for not rising up and saying no. And what are we optimistic about?
I think, well, first of all, folks need to come and see the film Body of War. And they need to meet Thomas Young by seeing this film, and Senator Robert Byrd by seeing this film. Terrible things have happened, and we have to move forward, and we have to create massive changes in this country. And you will see that there are good people in our government, and there's good people in our society that are trying to do the right thing and that are trying to create this change. And that's the note that our film ends on. And I want everybody to meet this family. I want everybody to meet Thomas Young and his mother and their stepfather and Thomas's brother. This family is a microcosm of America. And this family is held together by love. There are very, very differing opinions within the family. The stepfather and the brother are pro-war. In fact, Nathan, who lives here in Kansas City, is going back to Iraq soon for his third time. They have a very personal stake in bringing the troops home. It doesn't mean the same thing for this family. When they say bring the troops home, they're saying bring my son and bring my brother home and bring him home alive. And Nathan is doing what he feels is right. But the family, you know, they still love each other. They're still together. And I think that our country has to turn around. And we have to learn from this. And Body of War is not about 2002 anymore. It's really about the future. This film is about the future, and it's about looking at this and it being a history lesson and how not to let it happen again. I mean, that's what people said after the Holocaust. Let's not let this happen again. The Holocaust happened for the same reasons that this war happened, as Phil said earlier, fear. And we need not to be focusing on fear, but on focusing on turning things around in this country so that young people do have optimism and they don't look at things in the cynical way that has been going on for the last 8 years and more, perhaps.
Everything doesn't suck. You know, if you believe everything sucks, then you have entered a paralyzing world of cynicism. If you really believe that, you're not going to go outside the house. You're never going to stand on a street corner with a sign, I'll assure you that. You're never going to show up for a rally of any kind. You know, if everything sucks, you're not going to show up for a pro-war rally. And we don't believe that. We saw a lot of courage when we were putting this film together. 23 members of the United States Senate voted no. I mean, this is important. This is October 2002. This nation was so angry, we weren't able to spit. And 23 members of the United States Senate stood up. And against the wind, against the cold wind, and a hostile nation, they said no. Including one Republican. One Republican in the United States Senate voted no. His name is Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, and he was defeated for re-election. The job the White House did selling this war and marginalizing dissent was an advertising agency blueprint for success. Consider what they've done. They've said dissent is unpatriotic. Unpatriotic. We have millions of, how many hundreds of thousands of young men and women went to war to protect our way of life? And what's more fundamental to our way of life than free speech? There are people who will say, when your president calls a war, you shut up and sing. This is not the America that my parents raised me to pledge my allegiance to. We have so much to sell, really. This is the most fabulous experiment in democracy in the history of the universe. We are dealing with race, for example. No other nation on earth is as multi everything as we are. And it's been tough, and we're haven't arrived at the promised land, but the struggle has been so noble. We have finally, a long time it took, but we finally have come down from the mountain and said maybe it's not a good idea for the cops to bust in on people who they suspect are gay so they can catch them in the bedroom. Maybe that's not an American thing to do. Finally, the Supreme Court came down from the mountain and said no to the cops. You can't do this anymore. I mean, this is how noble we could be. It's hard to make this point without appearing to be pouring syrup over everything, and I don't mean to do that. There are far too many poor people in this country. The gap between the CEO and the workers is way, way too wide. Organized labor should be a fait accompli, and yet we've done everything we can to beat down those who would want to organize. It's awful, really. You know, there are people out there who see the union as some sort of communist, you know, the idea that the worker should have an equal playing field or level field when he sits down to the bargain table with the powerful management. What's more American than that? And yet we have people out there opposing. You know, labor is this, labor is that. So Ellen and I come out of this with, we're a lot more sober than when we went into this, really. This has been an emotional experience. I suppose we should have known it would be. I can't say that we thought it was going to be a walk in the park. But for myself, I didn't think it was going to be this complicated. And I didn't think it would get into my heart as it has. But it's what happens when you're this close to. And by the way, less than 5% of us in this nation have made a sacrifice for this war. So what you see in our film is a drama that's taking place behind 1,000 closed doors in this, thousands of closed doors. We have over 27,000 serious injuries. The injuries in this war are much more heinous, hideous, than with the IEDs and all the ways we've learned to kill people. We have people who are blind, 20-something blind. We have women had their face blown off. And it's a war that's been called by old men who want to prove they're tough and make the case they'll send your children to war. Certainly not their own. It's up to us, really. I mean, if there's anything I'm bringing out of this experience, the answer is not to be found in our stars, but in ourselves. Until we stop permitting the bomb throwers, the laptop bombers who sit in air-conditioned offices acting tough and calling for aggression, we will never, ever feel free until we get tough enough, courageous enough, to not be influenced by this war rhetoric and to appreciate the value of diplomacy. And to not just say it, but really believe that war means we have really somehow failed. The legacy of this war is going to rattle around our heads for the rest of this century. This nation has now got a huge challenge, and that is to reach out and somehow try to close the gap that has been opened by an administration that just couldn't wait to bomb Baghdad, a crowded city at night where old people and children are sleeping. And while it's happening, the American people are watching it on CNN.
Like a video game.
It's unbelievable. And boy, if you stood up and said, excuse me, I don't... Oh, you were blaming the victim. You didn't understand the real world. You weren't tough. You were a wimp. I mean, on and on it went. And it worked. Anybody who thought about opposing this war sat down. You know, and I guess I would have too if I were 34 years old with a mortgage and 2.5 kids and a Republican boss. How much am I going to pop off? My own case, it doesn't take that kind of courage. My kids are grown. I'm old and I have a little money, so... The least I can do is try and share Thomas Young's story with the rest of the nation.
Well, I'm glad you did. Phil Donahue, Ellen Spiro, co-producers, co-directors, Body of War. Any quick final words for our listeners?
Let me just get in a plug for our website, bodyofwar.com. Okay. Simple enough. And don't forget the album, Eddie Vedder and Bruce Springsteen,
and
Body of
the
War.
Title of that
the Body of War album. We got an album. I'm telling you, what do you call lucky here? Now all we got to do is convince people that this is a movie worth your time. And it is, sure, it's tough and it's up close. But I think Ellen is right. I think that when this is over, you know, you realize you've just watched a story about a comeback or a comeback in progress. Mm-hmm. This is Thomas Young trying to get up from the kitchen floor and somehow be somebody. And you don't appreciate how really challenging is his injury until you physically pick him up, as I have done, to move him to another chair. And when you're standing there behind him like the Heimlich maneuver and you pull him out of that chair, you realize how helpless he is and how grievous is this injury. But we've also got a story here about a young man who's able to move both arms. His brain has never been as active as it is now. He's politically passionate. He doesn't want this to happen to anybody else. And he is not saying, woe is me. He is saying, I can be a voice. And that's exactly what he's doing.
Thank you both for taking some time with us on Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Filmmakers Phil Donahue and Ellen Spiro. You heard Phil Donahue say that he was inspired by the Vietnam War photograph of the naked little girl, her clothes burned off by napalm, running down a road screaming. That little girl is now a mother living in Toronto. Speaking in California last July, Kim Fook said, "I should have died. My skin should have burned off my body. But I'm still beautiful, right?" Don't see a little girl crying out in fear and pain. See her as crying out for peace. And I remembered that Terry Gross on NPR's Fresh Air had interviewed Kim Fook a couple of years ago. So I looked that up and streamed it. In the interview, she talks of a picture taken with her and her son. And she says in the picture, "I hold my son on his first birthday. That is a picture that means I can hold my own son. I can hold my future, my hope, and that is my dream come true. That picture is a picture of love." Her son's name? Thomas. One thing that came up briefly in the Body of War interview was a mention of the notion of if we knew then what we know now. This has been voiced by, among others, Senators Hillary Clinton and Max Baucus. They said they regretted their votes in October 2002, authorizing George Bush to unleash shock and awe, and that, quote, "if we knew then what we know now, they wouldn't have voted that way, and that probably the vote wouldn't even have come up." Thinking about that again, I decided to also run today another bit of old audio, something I had nearly forgotten, but came across while I was searching for the Body of War interview in the basement. And that is a commentary that expresses what a lot of us knew then, and something that Clinton and Baucus et al. Surely knew as well, but allowed the putrid wind of political expedience to blow it out of their consciousness long enough to cast their votes. I read this piece called "The Good Germans" on the air on KKFI on the Heartland Labor Forum on March 21, 2002, just a couple days after a White House ultimatum and then some palace airstrikes, and just before shock and awe. Give a listen.
I remember learning as a child about how American soldiers who liberated areas of Nazi Germany around the concentration camps would gather up the good German citizens and force them to take a tour of the death camps that had operated in their backyards. I was reminded of this recently while watching a PBS documentary that showed film of one of these tours. The good German men and women were shown filing through the camps past piles of emaciated corpses. The narrator told us that the women would turn their heads away and cry out that they didn't know, that this wasn't their fault. Some would faint. And I remembered how as a child I wondered how the good people of an advanced, civilized country could have stood by and let bad men take over their country. Now, sadly, I begin to understand. As I wrote this, Bush was giving his 48-hour cowboy ultimatum to Saddam Hussein. "We didn't know," the women in the documentary said. "You should have known," I thought as a child. I quote now from a letter Bill Moyers wrote where he in turn quoted the Fox Network's Bill O'Reilly. In the aftermath of 9/11, Bill O'Reilly from his battle station at Fox was calling for the United States to bomb the Afghan infrastructure to rubble, the airport, the power plants, the water facilities, the roads. He went on to describe Afghanistan as a very primitive country and to say, "Taking out their ability to exist day to day will not be hard. Remember, the people of any country are ultimately responsible for the government they have. The Germans were responsible for Hitler. The Afghans are responsible for the Taliban. We should not target civilians, but if they don't rise up against this criminal government, they starve, period." According to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, O'Reilly added that in Iraq, their infrastructure must be destroyed and the population made to endure yet another round of intense pain. Maybe then the people here will finally overthrow Saddam. Well, I cannot advocate what are very specifically war crimes under the Geneva Convention, as does Mr. O'Reilly, but he does have a bit of a point about how the people of any country are responsible for the government they have. Do not we, as Americans, citizens of what many of us believe is the greatest democracy the world has seen, have at least as much responsibility for the government we have as the Afghanis and Iraqis have for their governments, which resulted, at least in some measure, from our global chess games as well as from their choices as citizens? And so I guess we're all responsible for Bush? Just before the cowboy speech, I heard a soundbite on the television from a man on the street who talked of the difficulty in knowing what is the right course to take with Iraq. And he concluded that we just have to trust that our leaders are doing the right thing. And if our leaders are doing the wrong thing, then what? Is this man as responsible for not knowing as the good German women who fainted at Jewish corpses were responsible for not knowing? As responsible as Mr. Riley says the good people of Afghanistan and Iraq are responsible? Mr. Bush's war has started without, so far as I know yet, the massive shock and awe attack on Baghdad. Whether that yet comes, or whether, as in Hitler's early conquests, invasion goes relatively easily, remains to be seen. But if, despite Mr. Bush's stated concern for the welfare of the Iraqi people, there is collateral damage to Iraqi civilians, should good American citizens like the man in the soundbite be forced to tour a Baghdad hospital and have a close-up, flesh-and-blood view of what collateral damage looks like when it happens to little girls and boys and women and old men? Should good American citizens like you and me be forced to view up close what depleted uranium contamination and sanctions and lack of medicine and lack of food and lack of clean water did to children in Iraq for 8 years on President Clinton's watch while we as a nation allowed ourselves to join a sick obsession with Clinton's sex life to the exclusion of almost anything else? Moot questions. We won't have our forced tours, at least not anytime soon. I got into a debate about Mr. Bush's war with a friend, and after I expended all my ammunition about how none of the Bush, Powell, Rumsfeld, Reif, Wolfowitz untruths put forth as justification for this war held water, she said that it was just refreshing to have a leader who actually believed in God, and that we needed to pull together and ask our Lord to guide him to do the right thing. Earlier, I had read some quotes attributed to Thomas Jefferson. In one of them, troubled slaveholder Jefferson says, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." Justice finally woke up for slavery. In his second inaugural address, Lincoln spoke of that justice in the midst of the slaughter of the Civil War. "Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid with another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Paybacks are hell, are they not? Bush 41 and Bush 43 have both been fond of comparing Saddam Hussein to Hitler. Saddam Hussein is indeed not a nice man. As a casual reader on the Middle East, I learned that in the mid-1980s. And if I knew it then, did Donald Rumsfeld not know it when he went to make nice with him in 1983? His role model was Stalin, not Hitler, but no question, Saddam Hussein is not a nice man. I don't compare Bush to Hitler. For one thing, the aging frat boy had no long-considered roadmap for his mayhem like Hitler's Mein Kampf. Although the writings of his posse invite comparison, see the observer.co.uk and the latest issue of Mother Jones for coverage of the Warhawks' 30-year-old plan for invasion. But I wonder if the important comparison with Nazi Germany involves not Saddam Hussein and Hitler, but rather the good Germans and the good people of America. If the Bush Doctrine is as wrong as it seems to be to me, how responsible are all of us? Should we stop our descent once the attack is launched because our troops are in harm's way? Would that really be a service to our fellow Americans in uniform and in danger? Should Germans have withheld descent after Poland was invaded? The good Germans, pretty early on, had much to fear as consequences of descent. We good Americans still have, I assume and I hope, the freedom to speak up. Is this just an exercise for those who like to dissent, or an obligation for every one of us? I haven't verified it, but I end with another quote attributed to Jefferson. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. Indeed, Mr. Jefferson, I tremble for my country.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.